Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss, as the Olympic torch begins its journey to Beijing, we'll look at the uprising in Tibet and the extent that China will be on the defensive as it hosts the Olympics in what was hoped to be a showcase of China's success. We'll be joined by Dr. Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, and she's a professor of political science at UC San Diego. Dr. Shirk first traveled to China in 1971, has been doing research there ever since. From 1997 to 2000, Dr. Shirk served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, with responsibilities for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. And she founded in 1993 and continues to lead the Northeast Asian Cooperative Dialogue, an unofficial forum for discussions of security issues among defense and foreign ministry officials and academics from the United States, China, Japan, Russia, and the Koreas. Dr. Shirk served as a member of the U.S. Defense Policy Board and the Board of Governors of the East-West Center in Hawaii and the Board of Trustees of the U.S.-Japan Foundation and the Board of Directors of the National Committee on United States-China Relations. Her new book is China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. And then, as the two Democratic candidates continue to commit political fratricide that could last through the whole summer, to the delight of John McCain, we will speak with Dr. Drew Weston, who's the author and professor of psychology at Emory University. His recently published book is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation, a book that Howard Dean said is a must-read. We will win the presidency if our candidate reads and acts on this book. Last week, in an article published at the Huffington Post, Dr. Weston analyzed presidential candidate Barack Obama's speech on race in America delivered in the wake of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright controversy. So we discuss which of the two candidates is connecting with the electorate in the way that Dr. Weston says they must. And then in the last segment, we'll speak with a young reporter who spent a total of two of the last 5 years covering the Iraq War. He's a freelance journalist and co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin, the post-invasion attempt to set up an English language news outlet in Iraq. David Enders will be joining us. Last week he covered the Winter Soldier gathering sponsored by the Iraq Veterans Against the War in Washington, around the country, and during which hundreds of veterans of both Iraq and Afghanistan presented testimony about the horrors of war, including atrocities which they had committed themselves or witnessed. I'm now speaking with Dr. Susan Shirk, as I mentioned, as the director of the University of California System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She's also a professor of political science at the UC San Diego and served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs from 1997 to 2000. And her new book is China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. And as I mentioned, Dr. Shirk, as the Olympic torch begins its journey tomorrow to Beijing, the uprising in Tibet and the extent to which China will be on the defensive as it hosts the Olympics, obviously they were hoping it would be a showcase for their success. Do you see this as a kind of gathering storm, and this could in fact not be what China wanted?
Well, it certainly isn't what China wanted, and it certainly casts a shadow over the build-up to the Olympics, but I don't necessarily see it as a gathering storm because the Tibetan protests are not very likely to stimulate protests from other groups within the Chinese population, and I think the Chinese are likely to use coercion now to get control over the situation. And so I think the Olympics will probably go forward as planned, although this definitely is a black mark on China's human rights record.
But I understand, Dr. Shirk, that these demonstrations and uprisings are not just restricted to Tibet. It's basically one-third of China's territory.
Well, it's true that something quite remarkable about these demonstrations is the fact that Tibetans living in Western China and even Tibetan students studying in Beijing have held demonstrations in sympathy with the Tibetans in Tibet. But you'll see that the Han Chinese, the majority of Chinese, are reacting not sympathetically, but in fact with a kind of nationalist backlash against the Tibetans, who from their standpoint, from the Chinese standpoint, are somehow spoilers and spoiling the whole celebration of the Olympics.
But this will continue though throughout. I mean, it may not spoil it for China, but in the outside world, I imagine that Tibet, Burma, Darfur, all of these protests will continue, will they not?
Well, certainly it's true that there is tremendous international support for the cause of the Tibetan people and for the Dalai Lama, and people are very upset about these demonstrations and being reminded about the religious and cultural repression in Tibet. But I don't believe that it will lead to a boycott by any country, even of any particular teams or athletes. There's some talk about some folks are recommending a symbolic not turning up for the opening ceremony. I doubt that there will be much of that. So because it's Tibetan and not representative of the larger Chinese population, this is why I think the impact is going to be somewhat less than we might think.
So if indeed China's coming out party is not spoiled, still, in many ways, the crux of your new book, Dr. Shirk, China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise, indicates that, in contrary to what we think over here is the Chinese economic miracle, after all, they are our creditor, that, in fact, the Chinese leadership are not drunk with success. In effect, they are paranoid and looking over their shoulders and, in effect, riding a tiger.
Yes, they're very, very nervous, very insecure. Ever since the Tiananmen demonstrations back in 1989 and the crackdown on those demonstrations, which occurred in more than 130 cities throughout China, China's leaders have been very worried that their days in power are numbered, and they react to domestic threats, revealing their insecurity. And certainly I think their unwillingness to talk with the Dalai Lama reveals this insecurity, because why should they think about it? What really is the threat of allowing greater cultural and religious freedom in Tibet and allowing Tibetan Buddhists to have pictures of the Dalai Lama? It's similar to their reluctance even to have Catholics in China recognize the authority of the Vatican and the Pope. You know, they're so worried about their control, which they feel is very tenuous, that they are unwilling to conceive of sharing it with any other organization or individual. And in the end, I think this will really doom them, because this kind of, you can see the frustrations bubbling up of the Tibetan people and the fact that these demonstrations turned violent this time, and it appears that the Dalai Lama's peaceful approach is losing favor with the people who see that it really hasn't been able to deliver much.
indicating that things will actually get worse for the Chinese.
That's right.
I guess they did get some good news in terms of the Taiwan election, where Ma Wing-ju, the Harvard-educated lawyer, former mayor of Taipei, Nationalist Party candidate, won. Clearly, China's been, again, harking back to the, to your book, Dr. Shek, the Chinese have always been pretty paranoid about Taiwan, particularly the notion that they might declare independence, and there were rumors of that during the last Taiwanese government's tenure. Mm-hmm. Later in the second hour, of course, we have Colonel Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff. He told me very clearly that that on the inside there were monumental battles going on within the Bush administration, particularly in the first 4 years, where in effect there were two China policies, Colin Powell's and Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld's. And he Wilkerson accuses Cheney and Rumsfeld of trying to gin up a Cold War with China, using Larry DeRida, Rumsfeld's deputy's wife, who was then the chargé, to encourage the Taiwanese to declare independence, which is almost causus belli from the Chinese point of view. Is that kind of internal two China policies, is it over with? Because I understand President Bush eventually decided to sort of throw his weight in behind the Walmarts and the economic reality and not go down the path of ginning up a new Cold War with China.
Yes, I think that once the president actually back in 2003 became so frustrated that the president of Taiwan, Chen Shui-bian, was launching a referendum that could really provoke Beijing into a military reaction, he figured he really didn't need a military conflict in the Taiwan Strait along with what was happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, and so he publicly disassociated himself and criticized Chen Shui-bian's actions. So I think ever since the president declared himself, we have had a unified policy in the Bush administration.
And do you expect any more mischief from Taiwan in terms of declaring themselves a separate country, no longer the Republic of China, but Taiwan?
Well, I think Ma Ying-jeou is definitely going to be more cautious, but it's important for us to recognize that it's not just a few Taiwanese politicians who take these positions, that Taiwan has nationalism too. And the vote for Ma Ying-jeou shows that people do not in Taiwan don't want to provoke a military reaction from China, and they do see that their economic fates are tied to the mainland, and they want to increase economic cooperation and reduce tension with the mainland. But on the other hand, they really have a lot of pride as Taiwanese, and it really depends on how Beijing reacts now to Ma Ying-jeou. This is a great opening for them, and it'll be a test of their leadership. Are they secure enough domestically to enter into a dialogue with Taiwan in order to stabilize cross-strait relations, even conceivably without preconditions? Or are they going to insist that Ma Ying-jeou says the magic words, One China, and kind of make him accept the PRC definition before they will talk to him? I'm very interested to see how pragmatic their policy will be.
Well, of course, the irony in all of this is, in spite of the saber-rattling and posturing between Taiwan and China and the threats and mm-hmm. counter-threats, Taiwan is the biggest single investor in China, mm-hmm. is it not?
That's right. Absolutely. And the economic ties are getting closer and closer. More than a million of the 23 million Taiwanese live on the mainland, engaged in business there. So, you know, if they can simply stabilize the political relationship in some way with an interim agreement or maybe gradual steps toward a final agreement, then I think the economic ties will lead to greater integration between the two sides.
And Dr. Shek, back in terms of our domestic politics, now that we have a one-China policy, President Bush clearly will come under continuing pressure to make some kind of a statement and speak out about the crackdown in Tibet. Nancy Pelosi, of course, has just met with the Dalai Lama. And these protests, I imagine, will not go away. They may well accelerate throughout the build-up to the Olympics. And I imagine that the Chinese, you know, just as you said, the Taiwanese have national pride. They have national pride. This is their big opening to the world. It would, in many ways, be a tragedy to see it turn sour. But on the other hand, you know, there are legitimate human rights questions here about China.
Well, I mean, frankly speaking, the international condemnation and making big public, sweeping public statements really has very limited value on the ground in Tibet. It doesn't really lead to any improvement in the situation for the Tibetan people. And what it does do is infuriate and alienate the Chinese public now. So my advice to President Bush would be to try to work the problem as quietly as possible with the Chinese leadership. But I wouldn't have any great expectations of an opening of dialogue with the Dalai Lama. I mean, that's obviously would be the right thing to do. The Dalai Lama is in favor of nonviolence. He has never advocated the independence of Taiwan. I mean, he's a man that the Chinese leadership could really work with. And they have made a much bigger problem for themselves by refusing to deal with him, by freezing him out. And now they have a younger generation of Tibetans who are impatient, who are frustrated. And we saw that in the violence that they displayed toward the Chinese population in Tibet. I mean, these protests in Tibet were a kind of an ugly ethnic riot in which they attacked hundreds of Chinese shops and shopkeepers and innocent Chinese who were there, you know, just trying to make a living. And now the Chinese public is reacting to that because the party is using its propaganda control to only put the pictures on television, on the internet, of Tibetans doing violence to Chinese. And so you've got a kind of ugly nationalist backlash from the Chinese public against the Tibetans. It's a pretty ugly and disheartening situation, which the Chinese leadership is largely responsible for because of their refusal to enter into a discussion with the Dalai Lama.
And what the Tibetans are reacting to is, in effect, a kind of, well, some, I suppose, the most the hyperbole would be cultural genocide. But the long and the short of it is, the Chinese have built a railroad in there. They've encouraged Chinese to move in there and take over businesses and essentially colonize the place.
Without giving economic opportunity to Tibetans and the population in Tibet, because they don't enforce the one-child family policy there, is younger than the average population in the rest of China. So you've got all these unemployed young people who are angry, who are not able to, you know, who've got pictures of the Dalai Lama hidden inside their shirts. You know, they're fighting mad, and they don't have much to lose by demonstrating and even demonstrating violently.
Well, Dr. Shek, I suppose we'll just have to see what happens as the celebrations get underway and the extent to which the China's coming out party may be crashed by the unwelcome political light on this on China's problems.
That's right. But, I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that I didn't think these protests would trigger protests from other types of groups in China because of the division between Tibetans and the Han Chinese.
Right.
But and I do also think that now the reports are that having gotten rid of all the independent and foreign media from the Tibetan areas, they have moved in the People's Armed Police and other security forces, and they're going to basically impose a kind of martial law in these Tibetan areas. So I think it will be very difficult for the Tibetans to continue these protests.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Susan Shirk.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I was speaking then with Dr. Susan Shirk, who was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs from 1997 to 2000. She's the author of a new book, China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. And as the two Democratic candidates continue to commit political fratricide that could last through the whole summer to the delight of John McCain, let me now turn to Dr. Drew Weston, who's the author of an author and professor of psychology at Emory University. His recently published book is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation, a book that Howard Dean said is a must-read. Quoting him, "We will win the presidency if our candidate reads and acts on this book." So, Drew Weston, which of the two candidates is connecting with the electorate in the way that your book says they must?
Each of them in half the way. It's actually about two-thirds of the way Obama and one-third of the way Hillary Clinton. The two-thirds that Obama is doing is, I think Obama's speech on Tuesday was just an extraordinary speech that was so far out of the ballpark of what we've heard from any politician in so many years on virtually any topic, in terms of combining the heart and the head. You know, it was a beautifully nuanced argument as well as a phenomenally moving one. I mean, I've been sort of struck by watching many of the talking heads on television who I don't know whether they had their limbic systems removed or and just can't have the emotional response, or whether they think it would be biased to describe any of their emotional reactions to the speech or anybody else's emotional reactions. But that was an example of the kind of connecting with people when he used his very personal examples from himself and his own life, when he did not do the politically expedient thing, which was to throw both Jeremiah Wright under the bus. Which took tremendous courage not to do, and when he also talked about simmering white anger that isn't just racism. No, those are not the kind of things that Democratic politicians typically do. And to make that kind of case in an emotionally compelling, intellectually compelling way was really extraordinary. And I think he's about. You know, if he were, and his stump speeches that have been connecting with people have clearly been just what the doctors ordered on the Democratic side, since the last person who could do anything like that, who happened to be Hillary Clinton's husband.
Well, clearly, Senator Obama made a speech that first of all was truthful and honest and open and not a political speech. First time, I think, in my memory that a politician has spoken as a human being. Yeah. and treated the audience as adults. Clearly, the chattering classes are offended by that because it essentially exposes the vacuous nature of the political debate that we have, where it's all about process and trivialities, rather than actually having a real dialogue with the American people. So, mm-hmm. So I assume that this could mean that Obama could be very successful. But I have to sort of pinch myself and remind myself that there are an alternative universe out there, known as the red states, and I would not discount the effect of this subversive underground campaign that's been launched from the very beginning, starting in conservative synagogues that, and spreading throughout the internet, the notion that Obama may well be a stealth Muslim. He may have made a secret pledge to bin Laden when he was at a madrasa somewhere in Indonesia, and all of this stuff that came out of the Jeremiah Wright thing indicates that he's anti-American. You know, 54% of the people in this country believe that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. There is an enormous amount of uneducated, stupid people, I'm sorry to say.
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing, too, is that a more substantial percent than you'd like are among the Democratic consulting class.
You mean they're just as stupid as the people out there that are likely to believe that Obama is a stealth Muslim?
Well, they're foolish in a different way, which is that that the one mistake that the Obama the two mistakes the Obama campaign has made, which is why I said two thirds Obama, one third Clinton. When you asked, you know, who's doing it in a way that connects with people, is that. They didn't learn the lessons from John Kerry and from Michael Dukakis, that you do not let a stealth campaign like the campaign of basically that started over a year ago on the internet, saying that he was Muslim and that he went to schools of madrasas, etc. That you don't let those stories fester. You don't let them fester for a day. You don't let Ann Coulter say, "Call you B. Hussein Obama," without a response. They should have seen it when they saw the really positive response that Elizabeth Edwards got when she called Ann Coulter on the carpet for her repulsive remarks about her and her husband, the idea that somehow if you just leave these things alone, if you talk about them, you dignify them. Is one of the most destructive ideas ever to enter into Democratic politics. Republicans have never been so foolish as to believe that. And the part of the Obama campaign that I think is the problem is this idea that you can win on positivity alone. And he could maintain the high ground while still firing back. When someone attacks your patriotism. It is not moving to the low ground to respond to them attacking your patriotism.
Right. Well, they already did that with the stupid lapel thing. I mean, does it mean if you wear a flag lapel on both lapels, does that make you twice as patriotic?
Well, that's it. And in fact, he started in his speech on Tuesday, his race speech. He really started to talk about a more complex vision of what patriotism is. You know, that patriotism isn't just what you wear in your on your lapel. It's what you wear inside, and that includes not just military service, which he made a good point of noting that both his white grandfather and Jeremiah Wright had both served in the U.S. military honorably, but that it is also patriotic to demand that our troops be taken care of well. It is also patriotic to dissent when it's time to dissent. I mean, there are complexities in this that aren't hard for the average person to hear and to understand, particularly in the midst of an unpopular war, and that just wearing just putting a support the troops sticker on your car is not patriotism.
But Dr. Weston, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Weston, the author of a book that's gotten an enormous amount of attention, particularly from the Democratic Party. Its nominal head, Howard Dean, described Dr. Weston's book, The Political Brain, as a must-read, and we will win the presidency if our candidate reads and acts on this book. And we're talking about the extent to which the two candidates running are borrowing from the idea of in Dr. Weston's books. But you still get back to this impasse that we're at now, where essentially neither of these two candidates is going to get sufficiently ahead for before the convention to win outright, and the convention, the choice of the candidate will by definition be chosen by the superdelegates, whether you like that or not. The die is cast here. But what is happening is that where you, there's not a lot of difference between the two of them, they're going after each other with petty differences over minor issues that get trumped up and become the story of the day. This is an unnecessary agony that will essentially diminish both of them throughout the summer. It will cost a fortune in wasted money that would otherwise go to Democratic House and Senate races. And there's going to be a lot of blood on the floor, and there'll be no numerical difference. So one of them's going to have to get out. And it seems to me that the only hope here is that Hillary Clinton eventually gets the message that the longer she stays in, the more she's destroying the party.
Well, there is something that no one wants to say in all this, which is that if it's just now starting to percolate up. There was an article this week in I think the Politico.com that described it that it is now numerically unless again barring some major gaffe from Obama, which he seems really unflappable. He's a very very difficult guy to get off of his game, and certainly not one who easily makes gaffes. And they've sort of hit him with their best shot, as has the right for some time, with this stealth campaign about his patriotism and his faith. The reality is, barring some major catastrophe on his side, it is very difficult to see the electoral math by which he can win on delegates. And if the superdelegates were to overturn view of the majority in the Democratic Party, and particularly in this race, if they were to do it when a black man had won, I think they'd see defections. I think people would vote with their feet in November, and there would be a landslide for John McCain. I mean, it's difficult to imagine getting more than a very small fraction of African Americans voting for Hillary Clinton if she is behind in the delegate count and still is awarded the nomination in the back room. And I think that's what Richardson was signaling this week. I think she certainly has every right to go through Pennsylvania to see if she can trounce him there. If she could trounce him there and say in North Carolina, she might be able to make an argument. But even then it would be very, very difficult for her to it's hard to do the math to have her overtaken in delegate counts, and that becomes the it for the superdelegates to overturn the will of the people. We saw that in 2000, and Democrats didn't like it very much when it happened back then. So I guess she's counting on maybe she could win the popular vote and make an argument from the popular vote, but that's really not boy, that would really bloody things up.
So if she doesn't do well on April the 22nd in Pennsylvania, even though she's ahead in the polls, but this is completely anecdotal, but it's my observation, and I don't really have a dog in this fight. But the more you see Obama, the more appealing he becomes, and the more you see Hillary, the less appealing she becomes, because she's on the defensive, she's strident, and she's basically not offering anything except He may be inspiring, but we don't need inspiration. It's like, what kind of a message is that? I mean, so do you think there's a chance that the party elders will see the writing on the wall here? I mean, the truth of the matter is that she's run a terrible campaign. She clearly doesn't have a very good grasp of how to, organize, be a chief executive. But on the other hand, she'd make an excellent majority leader in the Senate, and the Democratic Party are in terrible shape given the war and the economy collapsing around the Republicans' ear. The Democrats in the House and Senate should be able to pass legislation and stop this war, but they've proved feckless because Pelosi and Reid are absolutely useless. So it's not as if there's not a good job waiting for Hillary Clinton.
You know, what you're really speaking to is what the Democrats have the most trouble mustering, which is guts. And the irony in all of this is, and this is in many respects the irony in what's happened this week and what's happened the last few weeks, is that if you look at the impact of Obama's speech, for example, on working class male voters who have voted, I mean, white male voters have voted for Republicans since 1968 and have never come back. A substantial number came back, but under a majority for Bill Clinton. A substantial number came back the first time for Jimmy Carter and then defected in droves again because they saw him as weak in 1980. And the irony in all this is that what especially working class males want to see from a candidate is guts. And they almost don't care what your position is. I mean, this is where the one who knows this is Jim Webb. You know, you watch Jim Webb, and he has taken an anti-war position in the heart of the South, and he has huge backing from rural Virginians on it, because that man tells you where he stands, and he lets you know in no uncertain terms what he feels about it. And you know, he's one of the most conservative Democrats we have in the Congress, but on this particular issue, he is his position is indistinguishable from Russ Feingold and Ted Kennedy and Bob Byrd. But the irony is that for some reason the Democrats in Congress are having trouble getting the message that it isn't so much what stand you take; it's that you take a stand and that you dig your heels in and you don't argue about whether you've got the filibuster-proof majority. You know, you put the Republicans on notice. You vote against a bill that says that everybody who works for a living ought to be able to get to take their kids to a doctor. That's what SCHIP is. If you vote against that bill, we're going to take you out in the next election. So you better vote for it. I mean, that's how the Republicans won when they didn't have super majorities in the Senate. But the Democrats just aren't willing and able to do that. And they certainly need a leader. Who's going to get them to do that?
Well, you mentioned Jim Webb as being what the Democrats, what they should be, and why. And the reason they lose is that the Dukakis, Mondale, Kerry tradition of wimpery their track record is a proven disaster, and you always feel that what the Democrats need is a macho liberal, and they've obviously got one in Webb. What about Obama?
Well, the question is with him is, and this is why I gave him the two-thirds. He does positive emotions like no one else. This is a guy who can inspire. I mean, I don't know what you felt as you watched that speech on Tuesday, but I kept wiping the tears out of my eyes.
Well, it's true that my girlfriend was in tears. I watched it with her, so, and other people I've talked to said that too.
He is someone who can make you feel with him in a way that's just extraordinary. Again, I think of the two Kennedy brothers who could do that, Bobby and John. I think he's a better speaker than JFK was. He's more like FDR. Bill Clinton could do that, and much as I hate to say it, Ronald Reagan did it. He couldn't do it to me, but he could do it to a lot of Americans. What he has been unwilling to do is to throw those counterpunches that let the average American know, all right, I'm safe at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we saw it on Wednesday. He did it in his speech on Iraq, where he really did throw some of those punches and some of those elbows. And I think that there's a reluctance either on his part or the part of the campaign the idea is that somehow you can transcend doing that in politics. But you can tell a story about your candidate being above divisiveness at the same by attacking someone for their divisiveness. I mean, you don't have to pretend that you have no that you're so above the fray that you won't even respond to attacks or This week we're starting to see some Obama surrogates get out there. People need to see him respond and to show show some legitimate anger when someone attacks his honor or attacks his integrity or attacks his ability to lead. People need to see that from their potential commander in chief, and I think they've been waiting for it for him. And I think it's one of the reasons why the speech on Tuesday was such a strong speech, was because it emanated strength, it emanated fearlessness. It basically said, there's all this stuff that we Democrats haven't been talking about for 30 years, like the fact that not all of those resentments by white people are all prejudice. Some of those were real issues about having your kids shipped into the ghetto where you were scared about their safety. That's a normal reaction for a parent to have. To have a Democrat say that was actually a gutsy, ballsy thing to do. And I think, frankly, if he would do a few more of those, his numbers would probably soar.
And just in closing, Drew Weston, do you think there's any way that either of these two candidates can talk about the 900-pound gorilla in the room? I mean, obviously, the collapsing economy
yes.
is a pretty important issue, and that's totally playing in their favor. They don't have to do anything, and they can sit back and watch Bush twist in the wind on that one. But in terms of Iraq, clearly President Bush does not have a strategy. He's an abject coward who's going to hand this mess off to the next his successor. That's
right.
His strategy. They're going to keep the myth going that things are going well over there through the election period to protect the Republicans. They'll do anything they can to, alter the reality so that the public will basically think it's not a complete disaster. It will be a disaster at the end of the day. But the long and the short of it is, that's his strategy. Either he's delusional and doesn't know how bad it is, or he's a cynical SOB who knows how bad it is, and he's just going to hand it off to his successor. How in God's name have the Democrats allowed themselves to be put on the defensive? Why can't they turn this back on Bush and force him to explain his war, his strategy, his end game, his losing record?
Well, there are so many ways they could have and could be doing it now. They range from making, in some ways, a fairly obvious statement that we haven't heard from Democrats, which is that Americans don't like to lose wars, and we actually won this one. It took us the better part of 8 weeks before we toppled Saddam Hussein and had him hiding in a hole and marched into Baghdad. That's when we became an occupation, and you can't win an occupation. Then it became Halliburton's war, and Bush was clear about that. Everyone forgets how he talked about how we're not going to bring in a multinational force at this point, including, for example, perhaps some of Iraq's neighbors, because instead we're going to have a Christian army sitting for years on Muslim soil, because we wanted the spoils of war to go to America and its small band of allies. So there are so many ways that the Democrats could be talking about this, and I can tell you from having looked at some of these looked at them with voters and in focus groups, the Iraq War is a winning issue for Democrats if they would simply show some clear guts on it and not let it get turned into, well, is the surge working? The real question is, whatever happens with the surge, was this worth 4,000 American lives, 30,000 Americans severely damaged and what's happened to their families, countless numbers of tens of thousands of Iraqis, and frankly, what's probably going to amount to a couple of $1 trillion of money that is dumped onto our children to be paid for with money that we're borrowing from the Chinese. That's not a very pretty picture, and if you can't tell that story, you're in a lot of trouble. Mm. My last comment on this is that, given that, given the economy, given the tremendous anxiety people have about filling up their cars, paying for their heating fuel, and getting health care for their kids, if the Democrats can't win this one, So, you know, we'll have to see if I think you know, once we're down to one nominee, I think the numbers will start looking a lot better against.
Yeah,
John
that
McCain.
Obviously the bloodletting has to stop because it's a gift to John McCain. I thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Drew Weston.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, Dr. Drew Weston, the author of The Political Brain: The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation. I'm now speaking with David Endens, who has spent a total of two of the last 5 years covering the Iraq War in Iraq. He's a freelance journalist and the co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin, the first post-invasion attempt to set up an English-language news outlet in Iraq. Since the invasion, he has written for the Men's Journal, Mother Jones, and The Nation, as well as the London Sunday Times and other newspapers. His first book, Baghdad Bulletin, was published by the University of Michigan Press. And last week, he covered the Winter Soldier Gathering sponsored by Iraq Veterans Against the War, during which hundreds of veterans of both Iraq and Afghanistan presented testimony about the horrors of war, including atrocities which they had committed themselves or had witnessed. David, why do you think the Winter Soldiers' effort to tell the American people, at least from the point of view of the soldiers participating, about what they think this war is really about? Obviously, it didn't break through to the mainstream press, and as we were just discussing with Dr. Weston, the delusion continues that the surge is working, and President Bush clearly has only one policy and one strategy, and that is to pass this mess off to his successor.
Well, I guess people that weren't surprised that it didn't break through to the mainstream media, disappointed maybe, but talking with a lot of the IVAW guys, they see themselves as further along on the continuum of GI resistance than their peers in Vietnam, some of whom were present and helping organize the hearings, vets who have remained active since Vietnam. I think there's a sense that, of great frustration, though, amongst the vets, too, that like you said, this delusion continues, and then maybe even not so much a delusion, but just a total disengagement on the part of the American public, which still seems to fail to see itself more or less affected or involved, I think, by what's happening in Iraq. I mean, there were only 150, I think, people in the anti-war movement saw those hearings last week as much more effective than, say, the protests midweek in D.C., on Wednesday, which only a few hundred people turned out for. Probably fewer people were at those protests than were at the conference. So,
why is it then that the American public are disengaged? Is it? I mean, people say it's because there's no draft. Comparing to Vietnam, you were saying, in fact,
right,
that the veterans themselves, you think internally, have a better strategy.
Well, they think they do. Certainly. I am familiar with, you know...
Could you explain what you think their strategy is?
Well, just because they're more familiar with GI resistance. I mean, their points were that they can communicate in ways and are communicating in ways that did not occur in Vietnam, and therefore they have a much more unified front in what they're talking about and what they're demanding from the military. And so, and though I don't know if that's true, because in the case of numbers, I mean, in Vietnam you reach this point, obviously, where people are literally killing their officer.
Right.
But that is, you know, that was 72-73. The original Winter Soldier hearings were in 1971. So, but they are very different conflicts, and I think the vets, I mean, they talked about that a lot as well. But I think it was important. I mean, they saw it as important, and I think it was, you know, genuinely. I mean, this will start to resonate. You do see certain things shake themselves into the mainstream media. You know, things that'll get covered in places like Democracy Now. The Washington Post went to the hearings. They put it in the Metro section. Apparently, the story did not have national relevance because it was happening outside of D.C. It's a Metro story. But these things will start to resonate. I mean, you do see some of these journalists at the top, quote unquote, of the mainstream. Months after these things happen, if enough people continue to write about them and talk about them, it does filter down into some of the conventional wisdom. I mean, certainly, And I guess that was why it wasn't particularly surprising for some of the vets that there wasn't a lot of mainstream coverage. I mean, how long did it take the New York Times to figure out that there were no weapons?
Well, they had to reverse the obvious deal that the editors of the New York Times had made with the administration, which was to support that war. It's taken a while for everybody to understand. I mean, I guess at this point you can't. It's hard to believe that people don't think that it hasn't worked out well, and that there's some room for criticism.
I don't think Americans in general, and especially not in the media, want to see themselves as culpable in any way.
Well, nobody wants to lose a war, as Drew Weston was saying earlier. Obviously John McCain is appealing to that idea of our wounded pride, that how could we be beaten by these horrible fanatics? You know, I mean, it's a bitter pill to swallow. But tell me about what I think you were alluding to. I'm trying to get a handle on this. The Iraq vets who are organizing themselves politically, as opposed to the Vietnam vets, even though there was more traction in the country because the younger generation literally were about to be sent off to this quagmire, so they had a vested interest. We don't have that situation today. But are you suggesting, David Enders, that the Iraq vets of today have a better means to communicate with their fellow soldiers in the theater? I guess that would mean internet, etc. Is that what's going on?
Right. That's their argument. And I think that there's certainly some truth to that. And the Vietnam vets also said that they thought there was some truth to that.
So do you think what's happening on the ground there, which explains the drop in casualties, is not just that the ethnic cleansing has concluded in Baghdad, and that we've made a deal with the devil, the Sunni guys that were shooting at us, now we're arming them, presumably they're keeping their powder dry because they want to shoot at the Shiites at some point or other. We've managed to get Sada to behave himself because he obviously is keeping his powder dry too. What's happening on the day-to-day basis with these soldiers? Are they basically in some kind of I wouldn't say mutiny, but are they basically, they don't seem to patrol as much in the way they used to. Because every time they went out, they were likely to get blown up, which they often did. I'm just trying to get a feeling about whether the soldiers and their officers have agreed not to expose their troops to unnecessary dangers anymore, or is it because?
No, I don't. I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's the reasons you cited. People are arming rather than fighting at the moment, and then also you just have fewer U.S. operations. I mean, it's just logic that anytime there are more U.S. operations, more people being put out there, you're going to have more U.S. soldiers killed. And you see trends with that, right? The spikes are when the U.S. invades Fallujah, when the U.S. is fighting the X place. And so after the quote-unquote surge, which 5, 6 months ago was resulting in a lot more U.S. operations just generally, in Baghdad and around different parts of the country, you had more soldiers being killed. And then you do have this precipitous drop, in part because of, and it's not particularly precipitous, that's certainly not the right word, but you do have this drop, because the Sunni militias have changed sides. Well, not really changed sides, but made an alliance.
What's the status then? Describe to us the kind of military status. Is it a kind of garrison situation where they're hunkered down in the bases and they're letting the Sunni awakening people sort it out with the get rid of Al Qaeda? I mean, I imagine, Al Qaeda.
No, you still have the U.S. very much going out and doing small raids on what they term Al Qaeda. And you're seeing a lot more airstrikes. There is some truth to that idea of the garrison where I mean, that's what happens when you are not sending your soldiers out as much and they're spending a lot more time on these small outposts that they've got now. Or these small, they call them fire bases, like 100 guys in various places around, proximal to a much larger base. But this is the new strategy for dealing with these these new militias that are working within different parts, they can go back into these cities now, these little towns and places where they've begun working with the Sunni militias. And in doing so, they're doing the same thing to root out some elements of the Jaish al-Mehdi. There is still fighting with the Jaish al-Mehdi. The Green Zone was rocketed a number of times today. Usually those are Mehdi militia groups that are doing that. So you do have a lot of hostilities, and you have continued roadside bombs and attacks against, you know, Iraqi allies of the U.S. when the U.S. can't be attacked. But, I mean, you still have that occurring in multiple fronts. Mm-hmm.
Well, just in closing then, David Enders, given that you covered the Winter Soldiers, they're gathering this week, and we've seen that essentially their message is not getting out to the broader public. Perhaps the public, you know, I have turned off from this war, but it after all has cost $2 trillion. I mean, and when you say 4,000 lives and thousands, maybe 20, 30, 40,000 permanent injured, perhaps a million dead Iraqis. When you put it in that context, you'd think it would resonate a little bit.
You'd think so.
Does that mean that somebody's not making this case? Is that what's happening?
I think that's part of it. I mean, we've been talking to some congressional representatives about doing a screening of video we shot in Iraq last summer on the Hill. And I think sometimes when I'm talking to people in Washington, obviously there's a very surprising, at times, lack of understanding or knowledge or people seeing what's going on there. I think, like you said, there's disengagement because there's no draft. I mean, that there and even pro-war elements of the military will lament this, complain about it. They say, we're not a country at war, we're not paying attention to what's going on. I think that's just sadly...
Well, David, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us, and let's stay in touch. You going back to Iraq?
Definitely, this summer.
Okay. We'll hopefully talk to you over there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with David Enders, who spent the total of two of the last 5 years in Iraq covering the war. And I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, and Lick Duan, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.